Well, Happy New Year, everyone, wherever you are in the world and whatever time of day it is. Hi, my name's Andy Rice in Winchester in the UK. It's 5:30 in the evening for me on the 2nd of January. And for you, Hamish, what time of day is it for you and what have you been up to lately?
Hey, it's another early start for me. And I'm back on, we've had a week of sailing and we're back at West Haven, which is the marina. We've got our boat. You probably see the Harbour Bridge in the background. I don't know, it's right into the sun, but yeah. And I'm into work in an hour for a meeting. So it's, straight back into the fire again.
Right, so you're not just wearing the work wear to entertain us. It's because you are actually about to go back to work again. Okay.
Yeah, and then it's this Sunday, so yeah, not so good.
I see there's our first visitor to the chat box. Happy New Year to you, Steve. And yes, please be feel free to use that chat box to send questions through to us, to send through any comments that you have. And also, it might be nice to bring one or two of you in on the call as well, if we want to address any specifics and to give you an opportunity to have a conversation with Hamish directly. Now, it's only just gone 5:30, so we will wait a little bit longer and we'll do our usual thing of asking Hamish a bit more about what he's been up to in the last week. Road to Gold is always about improving from where you are to where you want to go. Hamish, what have you been working on in the last week, as well as doing some idyllic cruising and taking some time out? You've also been working hard on your skills as well. So tell us what progress you've made in what field.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty stoked, actually. We did about a couple of hundred miles on Adamite out to Great Barrier, which is our live on board cruising boat. But I probably did twice that on my wing foil. Every day the wind was perfect, 15 to 25 knots, and every anchorage had different types of breeze, which made it really challenging. Was pretty easy just to leave the wing slightly deflated and in the dinghy. Made it really easy, the foil on already attached, so it's like 3 minutes to go for a wing. So as soon as my energy levels came back up again, I'd be out again and charging back with some fours and learning to take off and learning to foil and trying to turn. Got the goals for the week.
So it's really taking off in New Zealand, and I'm sure it is in other places around the world. Just tell us where it fits in compared with some of the other water sports that have popped up in the last 15, 20 years, like kiteboarding and windsurfing before that. What's the unique appeal of windfoiling?
Well, I guess it's the simplicity for me. I've been an avid kiter, the last 5 years, and just on the twin tip, never foiling. But it's complicated, especially with cruising and trying to do a boat launch with all the strings and everything. You have to find the ideal place because you can't get back to the boat again. You can't necessarily get back into a sheltered area. When the kite falls out of the sky, you're pretty much done if there's no wind. Whereas the wing is an inflatable kite, simply put, with no strings, and you just hold on to the wing above your head, and the board is smallish, but it's still the board I have anyway is still able to hold my weight. So it's kind of like 110 liters, and it means that you can sail even in more or less no wind. You can still sail back to the boat or back to the beach. So it's much more safer and simple. And I think the whole foiling thing is really it's taken off, and everybody wants to foil something. And I think the wing, with its simplicity, has become the popular toy this Christmas in New Zealand.
So I guess it's a little bit like stand-up paddleboarding. It's so simple that, in the case of stand-up paddleboarding, anyone can do it. I guess the learning curve's a little bit harder with a wing foil, but it's that simplicity and the affordability and the portability of the equipment.
Totally, exactly. It all breaks down, and the bag for the foil is much bigger than a iPad, the wing, and the foil bag's a little bit bigger, maybe as long as whatever the mast is you're using. So for me, it's about a 800, less than a meter length mast, and then you fit all your foils around that bag, so it all packs down really nicely, and it's real real challenge to learn. You can tow with it behind a very small dinghy, which is what we've been doing to start with. So you're like, you know, skurfing behind the dinghy. You tow up and then you start foiling and then you learn to turn and learn to feel the foil under you. I think that's the real key, because it's just the smallest of movements that, you know, send you in different directions and you have some great spills.
And so this all feeds back into some of the things that you were talking about in chapter two of Road to Gold, about cross training as being a great way of working on your fitness and working on your mental agility as well. So keeping that every part of your brain and body engaged. How are you finding that? Which part of you is the most tired at the end of the day? Is it the muscles or is it the brain?
I think it's got everything, actually. You know, you're pretty tuckered out right through, and it's a real head game. You know, I've been helping a lot of people try to get foiling behind a dinghy, and you know, it's a real head game. You've actually got to just believe you can do it, because it's so foreign for humans to sort of be flying, and it's like flying. The board comes up out of the water and suddenly you're half a meter above the sea, and for most people that's when they just freak out and let go, you know. So you have to really have some mental, you know, capacity to just believe you can do it.
Now, I hear that 470 Olympic champion Joe Alley is getting pretty hot in this world of foiling as well. Tell us about her and just make a comment about the fact that she's conquered one Everest by winning an Olympic gold in a 470. And now she's national class, from what you say, in the foiling. So what is it about Joe Alley's approach that makes her able to conquer these different mountains?
Oh man, she's so determined. And when the, you know, foil arrived, this wing foil arrived, she just embraced it. A number of sailors have, but she certainly put more time in than anyone else, as you expect from someone like Joe Alley, who's, you know, world class gold medalist. But you know, she's as good as anyone. In fact, we were talking to her, one of her supporters, a young guy, about the idea of doing you know, doing something on Road to Gold on foiling, because it's becoming so popular. 3 out of the 10 Olympic classes in France will be foiling. So I think it's something we should address, Andy.
Okay, all right. You're going to make more homework for me, Hamish. Now, you said, I think, you know, Steve McBride asked, what is the wind minimum for foiling with a wing? And you were suggesting almost no wind. We got Dominic, who also adds a reply saying 7 or 8 knots. What do you really believe that you can foil in almost no wind?
Well, you can foil through patches of no wind. So, you know, that's the guy we're referring to, Joe Alley's supporter. He's closer to 100 kilos, and I saw him come down to the lake, and you know, there were little zephyrs of 7 or 8 knots, but there was big patches of glass in between. But incredibly athletic guy, you know, he managed to launch himself out off a sinker. And you know, obviously picked his foil, one of the best in New Zealand, and no one else was getting up, and he just managed to, you know, pump his way up out of the water and pump. You're pumping the foil and you're pumping the sail, the wing, and the right combination. It's incredibly difficult. We'll get you launched, and if you can just reach that first zephyr out of your launch, and then you can actually pump your way through the little glassy bits, and you're back into another puff of 7. So it's amazing what you can achieve in very little wind.
Now, both your kids, they're Olympians in their own right. Daniel following your footsteps in the 470, and Anna freestyle skier. If you were to get into a wing foil race with your kids right now, who'd win?
Well, Daniel managed to score my equipment. I bought him a nice wetsuit over the winter. His birthday falls at the beginning of winter in June. And then the next thing is my equipment disappeared into his garage. And I wasn't too worried about it. I wasn't that into going winging in the middle of winter, but he stepped out ahead of me. But my only claim there is that it took him, I think, an extra day to get up on the foil, whereas it took me, you know, I think it took me the second day to stand up, get up on the foil and go one way. But my claim there is I did do more towing behind the dinghy, so it was probably going to happen that way. But yeah, there's always an intense rivalry between me and Dan.
I can imagine. Now you're off to work in an hour or so's time, and you were telling me just before we opened up the call that you're going to be debriefing on what worked and what didn't for Emirates Team New Zealand during the Christmas racing, which of course is a very road to gold kind of approach of looking at what works and what doesn't. But you've left it until over Christmas and New Year to do that. And you're always telling us on Road to Gold, you've got to capture things in the moment. So are people going to remember what happened in that racing a few days back?
Well, everybody's, the debriefs were done before we left work, you know, so that's for sure. You need to capture it. And I think not straight away. It's quite good to let the emotions settle a bit. So, you know, I think a day or two after the event's about appropriate to get your learnings down. But we, you know, like with Road to Gold, we encourage everybody to take a diary throughout the event. So they knew exactly, you know, as things were happening at the time, they were able to record them and just let them go, because, you know, there are learnings going on all the time, and there's no, your head's not going to keep all those till the end. So you take a daily diary of how it was unfolding, what was, you know, what was good for breakfast, you know, how did you feel in the morning with your routines, and the next morning might have been slightly different, was that better? So, you know, all those things would have been captured in the diaries, and then from there you compile all that into, you know, the simple three questions that, you know, age old works, you know, what worked, what didn't work, and what would you do next time, you know, what you do better. So now's the point. Now's the time to try to put them into some kind of document that we can share with everybody.
With about 8 weeks to go until the America's Cup itself. So not very much time, but that, of course, means even less time for the challengers.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, we're seeing them back out in the water again. I think they've all been doing a little bit during the Christmas New Year break. And obviously the hammer's down for them as their regatta starts and, you know, 10 days time.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, just to remind people, we are going to have the first section of this Q&A about chapter 4. And that is the first part of Boat Speed, which we give two chapters to in Road to Gold. So this is Best Speed. And I hope that you're familiar with that term. But if you're not, don't worry. What I want to emphasize on these calls is, yes, there are people that are going through week by week, and that's the way that we're rolling out version one of Road to Gold, but don't feel that you're getting left behind if you're not going through it at that pace, or indeed if you've only just bought Road to Gold in the last few days, as a lot of people have done. So don't worry about that. We are going to address Best Speed questions to begin with, but we will hold open the later section to address any aspect of Road to Gold that you want to. But I'm going to reward one of our regular tuners in to these Q&As. That's Chris Loons. Happy New Year, Chris. And I'm going to start with your question. The 505 sailors now heat up the boat downwind and only sail a traditional downwind route in the lightest of airs. Do you have any thought on setting the kite and trimming with this approach to the run? So I suppose there are two different styles of running in the 505 now, Hamish, with a big kite. It's sort of sailing it like a 470 in lighter winds, or sailing it like a 49er in stronger winds. I should also say Penny Clark, one of the best in the world in the 505, is on this call, so we can always get Penny in for her view if she cares to share that with us.
Yeah, no, there's something that came about in the 470, I remember, in the, you know, it was sort of played with a little bit, and it became more and more successful in strong winds to, you know, jibe downwind on, you know, sort of jibing through 30, 40 degree, you know, angle, good angles, 140s, 150, 130s. And it was successful if you could link up a couple of puffs and the wave state was in a certain, you know, if the wave train was advantageous to reaching rather than running, it was working really well. But if you had a bigger rolling, faster moving swell, then you could go deeper and stay on the swell. And, you know, remembering that, you know, swells are often running quite fast, you know, especially ocean swells. And if you could stay deeper on the swell, it was always better to go straight. So that might answer some of your questions, but I think every class is absolutely unique and requires, you know, a little bit of you know, looking at the best to figure out when and when to do it, when and where to do it. So yeah, Penny wants to come on, that'd be awesome.
All right, well, the offer's there, Penny, if you'd like to join us. On a similar note, another regular, Kevin Kenny, Happy New Year, Kevin. I'm going to come back to you, actually, Kevin. It's Scott, Scott Zimmerman, and the Melges 24 question, that in a breeze of 10 to 13 knots, the first team to get up on the plane downwind runs away from everyone. So Scott's asking, without the best in class to pace yourself against, what drills or ideas do you have for being able to dial in on this first to plane skill? So again, it's this dilemma that you have in this crossover breeze, Hamish, a little bit like the 505 question. When do you know that you should be arcing it up and really pushing high to build the apparent to get on the plane, and when should you keep on soaking?
Well, actually, I just saw a little note from Penny saying that she would love to come on and answer that question from the 505 perspective. If we want to, we could let her in and get her thoughts.
Let's do that. Okay. So yeah, Benedict, our host, if you can bring in Penny, let's see what Penny's got to say about that.
Yeah. Hi, Andy. You're in luck because you've not only got the idiot at the back of the boat, but you've got the super crew at the front of the boat in the pool as well.
Does he have a name? Does the mute have a name?
Russ is here. Yeah. It kind of touches on that next question as well, and links in with a lot of what Hamish has been talking about in the Road for Goal anyway, is one of the things we have been really looking at hard in the 505 is that transition point, and using training partners, Ben McGrain and Roger Gilbert, to try and suss some of that stuff out and get it, everything that Hamish has talked about, the partnerships, the people that you work with in your team, getting them on board, good discussions before we go out and what we want to work on. And one of mine and Russ's specific goals is trying to figure out, how do you know when you go around that windward mark whether you want to square run or trapeze downwind and get the boat going? And we've identified Roger and Ben are actually really good at that. And they're really good at making a halfway mode work as well, where Ben is really crouched on the wire on the side of the boat and Roger sits in the bottom of the boat, and they have this intermediate position between the two. So absolutely sit with everything Hamish has said previously in some of the other chapters about who you work with, how you set that up, and then how you go out. And on the days when we've had good puffy conditions, specifically going out with Roger and Ben, working on that. From the trimming perspective, I'm going to hand over to the guy who trims the kite, and over to Russ.
Hamish, Andy, hi, and good morning, good evening. I'll keep this really straightforward. Hamish, probably what I'd do most is just concentrate on the basics. Pole height initially, just to get a sense of where the luff is curling, and whether it's curling at the top, the bottom, or in the middle. And I'll always go for the middle setting, so the sort of optimum normal approach to trimming a symmetric kite. From there, we do have one little trick up our sleeves, which came apparent when I posted a picture on Facebook, which is we don't have a crane for the halyard in a 5-0. So we just put a sort of three-finger gap between the stopper knot and the head of the sail, just to allow it to rotate a little bit from there. But that's the basics. There are a couple of circumstances tactically where if we are hot on a ley line, so having to heat it up a bit, we might drop the pole end down a bit just to tighten the luff up and allow the leech of the kite to open a bit, because it's such a big, broad-shouldered kite. It just blows us sideways. Otherwise, I'll stick to the basics, Andy.
In terms of the tactical decisions, if you're in those crossover conditions and you don't know whether to stick or twist on whether to go high or whether to soak low, where do you tend to default to?
It's easier to put yourselves on the side of, tend to find that it's easier to be on the side of a race course downwind than if you're in the leading group and you go dead downwind first, and then the group behind goes into an angle mode and sailing hot angles, you're effectively in their wind zone. And if there's a big fleet behind you all lined up, then you just tend to lose the gas. So my preference is to push us to one side or other, and then it gives us options. but it's a discussion we'll try and have before we get to the top mark.
Yeah, if Ross is flat wiring and we're fully powered up, then we know we're always going to give it a go of wiring downwind. It's when it's marginal, that's when. So we've already got that trigger that you won't even need the discussion until we know that Ross is marginal wiring and we're on a certain rig setting that it's even going to be an option. And as Ross says then, I'd prefer to stay to the edges where the wind is clear and then fight my way back in from there than get sucked into the middle.
Penny and Russ, thank you very much for that. We might come back to you later, but some good feedback there. And we've got some other fantastic sailors that I see have come in on this call as well that we might well be turning to as well. We've suddenly got a lot of questions to take. I'm going to come back to... I'm going to say hello to Veronica Zivner, who was one of the stars of our first Q&A back in December, which already seems like a long time ago. But welcome back, Veronica. Happy New Year. In the topic about steering in 49ers, should there be a lot of pressure on the rudder or not? I'm struggling a bit with it because sometimes there is a lot of pressure on the tiller. So, Hamish, what's the tiller telling Veronica if she's feeling a lot of pressure there?
Yeah, I mean, the 49ers got a pretty small rudder. FX has got a pretty small rudder for the amount of gear up there. And generally, it's I've noticed it does, well, the feedback I've been getting is it stays pretty loaded quite often. And, you know, you've got to keep back to the basics, you know, and we talk a lot about this and tuning that all your controllables, your settings, what you know, your controls in terms of how you're sailing the boat and where you sit or move on the boat, all has a bearing. You know, if you're feeling loaded and you're already, let's say you're downwind and 18 knots and you're already as far back in the boat and the spinnaker's flowing well and the main's set well, then there's not much else you can do, just hang on. But, you know, your heel angle still has a big bearing on load. You know, the more the boat heels, the more loaded the rudder will be, and the more the boat comes to windward, the less loaded it'll be. So I think we do a really good job of just talking about those, all those basics and what effect they have on weather helm, because weather helm is absolutely key driver in establishing your best speed for the boat.
Well, a similar question. I'll come back to the one I was going to raise from Kevin Kenny earlier because it's now relevant to Veronica's question. So Kevin asks, with both sailmakers in my keelboat class say that when you go let the helm go in optimal power mode, the boat should track straight for 3 to 5 seconds. And then one sailmaker says the boat should slowly bear off, i.e. lee helm, and the other sailmaker says it should slowly head up, i.e. weather helm. How do you reconcile this difference?
Yeah, I think I can't imagine you'd want a boat to bear away at any stage. That would, to me, would be wrong, because you normally, if you're looking at America's Cup boats or whatever, the designers are trying to get around, you know, 5-8 degrees of rudder. It's almost like a trim tab, you know. So every boat I've sailed always gives me a little bit of weather helm feel. So I'd be surprised if you're getting lee helm, which means you're getting lee helm for it to bear away. So I would think, you know, the first sailmaker's observation's about right, that it should slowly round up. You know, there'll probably be moments in time when you've flattened the boat out or even brought in some windward heel where you could neutralize the rudder. But I think overall, you're looking to tune the boat and manage the boat for a little bit of weather helm feel.
Okay, thank you. Now, one of the key messages that comes out time and again through Rotogold is the power of the squad. And I'm sure that anyone who's worked their way through the first four chapters is getting that message loud and clear. And it's great to hear the relationship that Penny and Russ Clark have with their training partners, Roger and Ben, in the 505. And it's clearly working for both of those teams. They're both at the top of their game in the 505. So we know that stuff works. I've got a question from Nuno Barreto, and Nuno is saying that we talk quite often about swapping boats for boat testing within a squad. Now, Nuno says, I totally agree with the idea, but a lot of times it's already difficult to put the different teams to share their feelings and have good feedback from them when we're in a meeting together. Making them swap boats is even harder. How do you manage that within a squad?
Yeah, it's really tricky. I agree. It's obviously, you know, can be quite a sensitive moment, and it's often a bit of a hurdle to get them to jump through, you know, to jump over. It is achievable, like everything, and there's so many learnings. And provided everybody has that, you know, there's a bit of equality around the squad in terms of their performance, then there's not one person looking back at a whole bunch of, you know, young, well, others coming at them, you know. If there's a kind of equality within their performance as well as within what they're doing together, then it's a lot easier because, you know, typically, even if someone is protecting something that they feel is a bit special about their boat or equipment, I've always noticed that when this happens, that person is the first to observe something special and interesting about someone else's equipment that they've learned and they're going to apply in the future. So I think, you know, the learnings are often the strongest from the best, or the most resistant, I should say. So, you know, I think you just got to push them along, and it's never easy, but getting that buy-in. But you've got to just keep on demonstrating. If you're facilitating a group like that, you just got to keep demonstrating that this is you. This is the way to learn. This is the way to move forward at a faster rate than you would otherwise.
Yeah, and there are so many examples we can think of in Olympic classes, like the strength of the Finn duo in New Zealand, the traditional strength of the British squad in the Finn, and the current strength of the Laser squad for GBR. I'm sorry if I'm being a bit GBR biased, but those are the ones that I know most about. But it's proven time and again. But Hamish, you've proven to be a master of getting these teams to work together as a team, as one big unit. But I think this question is going to keep on coming up because people just can't let go of the idea of keeping hold of information to themselves. So thank you for that question. You know, I don't think it's the last time that we're going to be asked it. He's also got another question on kinetics. And on the 470 class with free pumping, do you think that the class will end up like the RSX, where the team that manages to pump all the time upwind downwind will have a huge advantage, or the other way, the other ones that can't will have no chance?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I'm a bit kind of a, I mean, as an old 470 sailor, you know, you sort of wonder where it's going. You know, they keep dropping the wind limits another knot. And when does it become, you know, rowing? And I think that was always the question asked about the, you know, windsurfing pumping, is that it looked a little bit more like rowing than sailing. At some point, you know, when the wind dropped enough, everybody was just pumping. You know, that obviously, as a traditionalist, you sort of want to see the sport look like sailing. So I would think, you know, you've just got to figure out where the wind limits are to make it, you know, appear right. And in terms of, it still looks like a sailing class, not a rowing, you know, not a pumping, pump off rowing thon. So, you know, I think, you know, with the class going unisex, I don't know that's the right word, but, you know, co-ed or whatever it is, then, you know, the considerations too to increase the participation as well, you know, because it's physically incredibly, you know, incredibly demanding. And, you know, you want to try to open up the participation as much as possible. I'd be really thinking to lift the wind limits up a little bit more than they are in the 470. So, you know, there is a sweet spot there where you've kind of, you're pumping, like I always used to pump, but it was under the rule of three per wave. And so you could, you know, you could probably pump continuously if you wanted to pump up wind, because you're always on a wave, aren't you? And three's a lot. So there was a sweet spot where you are pumping in harmony with the waves and the boat's steering, and I think it looks really good. And then there's a point where you're below that and the water's absolutely flat and there's not a ripple on it, and you're just pumping to fan the leech, and probably somewhere there is not right. So I would think that, you know, the wind limit maybe needs to be addressed, go up a knot or two.
Oh, well, we're not here to try to change the world in that respect. So it's good to get your input, but we work with what we're given. And at the moment, unfortunately, those are the way the rules is. Coming back to the things that we can address, still in the 470, but it applies, I think, to many other classes. Josh Yale is asking that, or pointing out that you often see some teams trying to force the crew on the wire in lighter winds when sailing upwind with the crew sitting on the floor. I wonder if he means with the helm sitting on the floor.
Yeah.
And downwind in heavy breeze, have the crew on the wire with the skipper sitting to leeward, often dubbed the wild thing. Well, I think we deal with that quite well in the so-called the wild thing, and having the sort of the fishing trawler stabilization. I think that's well dealt with in chapter four, Josh. So take a look there. But let's talk about the helm sitting in the bottom of the boat and the crew on the wire. What would be the benefit there, Hamish?
Yeah, well, we've seen that happen a bit. And, you know, if the helm's good enough at seeing around and feeling where the waves and the wind are, then obviously you're reducing windage massively. You know, and windage is always one of the battles you face in yachting. So, you know, getting rid of that windage is important. And getting the crew in control of the balance can often work, because, you know, there's a point where if you're both working on it, then you'll see this in the 49er and the FX a lot. When both helm and crew are working on it together, they can be a little bit too reactionary. If you have one and then you need the other, that's fine. But if one is primarily responsible for keeping the sideways balance, and then the other helps out if it's too much, the swells are too big or the puffs are too strong, that's a good way to go. Otherwise it becomes the boat. You want to keep the mast upright all the time and not having it, being moved to leeward and to windward. And your reaction as the crew trimming the boat for the sideways heel needs to have that as a goal. And I think having one person, helm in, crew out, often achieves that less reactionary response, and passing the responsibility onto one person as a primary is a good option.
Okay, great. And it does seem like when the helm is that low in the boat, it has an effect on the movement of the boat through the water, and also the helm feels a lot more locked into the boat in terms of understanding small amounts of heel and small amounts of angle change in the heel of the boat.
Yeah, well, I remember Nick Asher was one of the best in the 470 in that light stuff, and it wasn't really sitting on the bottom of the boat that he did. He was kind of on his toes, with the feet kind of splayed out as if he was surfing, the boat rather than just sitting. And I'm talking about more when it was wavy, when it was really important. And Nasher and Elliott were, one of the fastest in those conditions. So, I think got two world championships. And they did.
That's right, they did.
Yeah, so, I think it's not really static. It's still being able to move and help a little bit, but, squatting rather than sitting.
Okay, great, thank you. Staying with kinetics, but now going to single-handers. So, Mara Dewey, hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Mara. Can you talk about using body movements and leech flicks to sail quickly through chop for single-handed laser and fin, outboard body pump, talking sheet drops, how often? Hamish, you're welcome to answer that, or we could bring in Olympic champion Lily Zhu if she wants to answer that for us as well.
That sounds like a great idea, Andy.
All right, so John and Lily, if we want to fire up the John and Lily show, if you want to answer that question for us, for Mara.
I think for me, my style is quite a smooth sailor, so I would much prefer to sail in a big wave, so just steer very smoothly with my tiller and then sheeting and sheet out. So all the time, John's really having a difficult time, a very hard time, to teach me how to have some aggressive movement and explosive movement in those choppy waters. So for example, for the radial class, probably Alison Young is the best in the female fleet. And she's so aggressive. And then I just can't think a female can bring out that kind of movement. And then the other one I can remember is Marit Baumeister. Like they sell super fast in those choppy flat water. Whereas I do admit I struggle a bit. It was not until, for example, in the London Olympics, we compete both inside the harbour and outside the bay. So I have the opportunity to catch up a little bit while sailing in the big waves. So probably John can add a little bit more of how to better grasp the timing of choppy technique.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably two things. The first, to answer the question about how many, I mean, the rules are very clear. It's repeated. So therefore, you know, for each wave, you can only do it once. More than once is repeating. But I think the mode of sailing is very important. I would say Marit is very, very good in the short chop, having spent a lot of time on the Isselmere. But the Baldale mode works very well because it's really important to keep your average speed high. So if you do hit a bit of chop, your average speed stays high because it takes a lot longer to get back to full speed than it would do in flat water. And I do see some young sailors, bless them, working their socks off. But if you get the timing perfectly wrong, you make it far worse than if you hadn't actually done anything in the first place.
Okay, and it's such a subtle set of movements, it seems. It must be really easy to think that you're copying the best and getting it completely wrong, as you just mentioned there, John. What are the best exercises for working towards the best technique, would you say?
I've just been asked by the UKLA to write an article on that. And the truth is, the best thing is just to go sailing. I don't know why, but there's nothing else which is that applicable. But what you have to think about is your end goal. So upwind, you're trying to maximise your progress to the windward mark. So that's not going as fast as possible or going as high as possible. It's your VMG. But with the little chop, you've still got the goal of the boat as flat as possible, both in terms of trim, so forward and aft, and sideways. And everything you're doing is to keep that, just exactly what Hamish said. You want the mast just pointing straight at the sky and not moving. So the boat doesn't know there's any movement going along, but the sailor's working like crazy to keep the boat tracking in a complete straight line. And sometimes that means a lot of sheer, a lot of steering and a lot of body movement. But actually, the boat is just going on in a straight line. And the worst thing for a lot of boats is large amounts of corrective steering when the trim and balance isn't correct.
I probably will still add on watching the video of those best in the world first, because I remember after London Olympics that I got the footage. And then I grasp how Ellie's is actually hiking aggressively in those choppy water. I have no idea in the past. So get a feel of watching those top sailors and then try to mimic them and have a feel yourself on the water practicing, and then finally work out what's best for you.
I also think another very important thing, Andy, in terms of the technique, you have to have a really rock solid core. Because otherwise, if you do all those vigorous, explosive upper body exercises and your core isn't strong enough, it's going to be lower back injury all over.
John and Lily, thank you very much for that, with the health warning at the end of that message as well. Very much.
I just have to say every time, I'm sorry, Andy, very close to home.
No, I understand that. You both had your challenges with that. So anyway, thank you very much. Some great advice there. And Mara, oh, great, Mara, thank you. Thanks for confirming that was helpful. I'm glad that it was. And we've got some really good questions coming through. And Hamish, this is very much back in your sweet spot. I don't think anyone's better qualified to answer Dominic's question when he asks, when do you know that helmsman and crew are too far back in the back of a planing 49er? But, and he's asking for both upwind and downwind.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. I mean, in light air, it's quite obvious when you aren't far enough forward, you can see that the transom is pressing into the water, and you can't see that on the boat, of course, but you can ask your fellow competitor to have a look, or you can get the coach to check it. And it seems to be really important in Lydia that you, you know, you're not pressing the transom in the water. So you need, you know, a decent amount of bow down trim in the 49er in Lydia, and it makes a big difference. And you'll watch the crews progress, you know, from in front of the mast to sort of lying on the spinnaker sock as it gets lighter downwind. So upwind and downwind in Lydia, getting the boat properly balanced is pretty key to performance. As the breeze increases, it's like we talked about in that chapter, that there's a magic pivot point. And it's totally related to boat speed. So the faster you go, the further back you get in the boat. And because the wind's never constant or really constant, and even if the wind was constant, that usually comes with bigger waves because the wind's onshore and steady. So the boat speed's never constant. So that means that you've got to feel that pivot or that perfect point at all stages and make sure that you're moving forward and back along the gunwale to ensure that it's trimmed correctly fore and aft all the time. And if you watch the good sailors, you know, they're never static. They're always, you know, moving their weight forward and back along the gunwale all the time in a constant state, just feeling for that perfect position. And it's a bit the chicken and the egg. You know, you can promote more speed to a point by moving back, and you can promote less speed and more height by moving forward. So you can manage, which is what we spend a lot of time talking about in the next chapter. You can manage your best speed according to wind, boats, and marks.
Yeah, so as you say, in part two of boat speed, in race speed, we talk about how you manipulate your body weight around that perfect pivot point that Hamish talks about. So there'll be more to come on that in the chapter coming next week. Focusing on sail trim, calibration marks are obviously crucial for accuracy and replication. Do you have any tips or good methods to use for calibration marks, specifically lines with high purchase, such as a jib sheet on a 49er?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways to go about it. And, the one of the things I think becomes obvious to me is the best sailors can actually just look at the sail, a jib as an example, and know whether it's in the right trim just on the way it's behaving. So, you know, for instance, you'll pull the sheet on a little bit and you'll notice a change at the spreader, because in the 49er you can look through and see where it is, and you'll know that you shouldn't have been able to pull the sheet. You should have pulled the sheet more or less for that change given that setting and what you're looking to get out of the jib in that wind range, and you'll know whether actually the jib needs to go higher or lower on the forestay in order to change the angle of the sheet to the sail immediately. It can feel right or wrong. And so it's just that familiarity. So initially marks are good because you'll start to recognize familiar settings. But really what you want to be doing is looking at the sail overall, you know, not just the specific, the sheet. Like you can put sheet marks on the jib sheet that runs through the sail, like with a permanent marker, and a lot of people do that in the 470. Then you immediately look at the sheet and go, okay, in relation to that mark on the sail, it's looking like that or it's looking like that, and you can see where it goes. And that's a good way to start the familiarity of the relationship of the angle of the sheet to what it's doing to the sail. If it's back like this, it's stretching the bottom of the sail out. And if it's up like this, it's making the bottom of the sail deeper and directing the load up the leech. So that's a good starting point. But after that, you're really just looking at what's happening to the sail when you change those settings overall, the global sail.
I remember the great Paul Elvstrom, considered by many to be one of the greatest Olympians ever. He said you should never calibrate anything because then you get lazy and you're not paying attention. But he did change his mind later on in his career. And I wondered if that was as races got shorter, because maybe when you were doing one race a day and it was a massive long race, then you could spend the time to tweak and to change things by eye. But when you're doing a 20 to 30 minute race in a 49er and everything is so hectic, you surely need those calibration marks just to get things in the right ballpark.
Yeah, I think you have to be very instinctive about where your settings are these days, because the courses are so short and you haven't really got time to spend looking up and examining everything. But you have plenty of time in training and tuning and testing. So that's the time to really get familiar at it, and then test yourself that you are familiar enough at it. And, I think we've talked about this in the Road to Gold too, but we often found we were the fastest in the world on the race course, but we weren't necessarily the fastest in the world when we did a tuning run. So there would be boats that could match us on a tuning run, but those same boats could never match us on a race course. You know, when you come out of attack and you immediately got to put the boat in the right mode, or when the wind changes. And you'll see that with Peter and Blair too. You know, the people can match them for a period of time, but then there'll be a change that you have to react to, and they won't get that change. So it's really important to be able to blend the two things together. Your best speed and then mode changes go hand in hand. So test yourself over both.
And again, you're touching on some of the subjects that we go into more deeply in Chapter 5, the one coming up next week, which is race speed. Now, Jan Willem, you've been very patient, because Jan Willem, you've sent in your questions to ask Hamish at roadtogold.net as well. So I'm sorry we haven't got round to you yet, but thank you for reminding me in the chat box. On RSAOP, now I hope you all know, I hope you've all done your homework and you know what RSAOP is, but it's rolling, steering, apparent, ooching and pumping. Am I correct, Hamish?
Yeah.
And he's asking for upwind kinetics in non-foiling multi-hulls. The best in our class sail the boat pretty static in order to not disturb the flow of the boat. Downwind, we like to put in a lot of fore and aft movement to catch the wave. Is there a balance in using kinetics on a multi-hull? And I would even ask, because I'm interested to know for my Musto skiff, is RSAOP actually relevant to faster boats like the Musto skiff or the 49er, for example?
I think there's the subtleties of it all, you know, that are relevant to all classes. You know, I've been watching, over the winter, we've been doing a lot of Elliott keelboat, sport boat racing within the Olympic squad. And you can see a lot of it going on even with those boats. They must weigh, you know, at least a couple of ton, 2,000 kilos. But you've, you know, with a crew that probably weighs, 300 kilos. So, you know, there's still a lot going on in getting performance out of those asymmetrical sports boats downwind, in the subtleties of RSAOP. So, you know, you've just got to be conscious that there's all of those at your fingertips, and they're all tools you can use in your toolbox. And even if you're just using a little bit of them at any one point, or half of them, that's fine. You're still making progress, and you're still putting performance into a boat that wasn't going to have that performance available without those tools.
I'm going to do another question from Jan Willem, who is campaigning a Dart 18 for the Worlds that are due to take place in La Rochelle this summer. Let's hope that happens. Through your manoeuvres, should you be looking for... Well, he gives some explanation of the strange setup of the Dart 18, which doesn't have dagger boards. It's got skegs for sideways resistance. So, and I don't know if you've sailed one, Hamish. So, you know, it's quite a unique kind of design. But through your maneuvers, should you be looking for best speed, or just accept the limitations of the boat that the boat design brings to performing a smooth and quick tack? And I suppose it's like, do you just do a quick and dirty tack and then look for your best speed again, or are you trying to maintain good speed through the tack?
Yeah, well, that's probably a unique answer to that, to a unique class. And I think all classes have, you know, characteristics that are unique. And you need to just explore the boundaries of what you can do in terms of a roll tack. I'm assuming he's referring to a roll tack that you put into a traditional class. But what I do notice is interesting is that when you put, the top sailor, when you transport them out of their you know, whatever class they're in, into another class, it's usual to find that they're still able to perform really, really well on, you know, straight out of the bat in a completely unfamiliar class. So the skills that you're learning across the board, if you get to manage them well and become the best at it, you know, you should be able to apply them to any class and jump in and do well.
And it reminds me of what Lily told us 10 or 15 minutes ago, that she had already won the Olympic gold in the laser radio London 2012. And then it wasn't until she was watching YouTube after that that she realized that she was still missing out on some technique and sailing the boat upwind through waves. So Jan Willem, if there's some good YouTube footage out there of Dart 18s being sailed world class. Actually, funny enough, the world champions in the Dart 18 are next to me in my Musto skiff at Stokes Bay. So I'll ask them as well next time I see them. But, you know, I think there's a good general message there that in the age of the internet, there is so much good information out there. If you go looking for it, I know that Lily is really into using YouTube to learn, and I've heard Nathan Outridge say that before, and I think you said that last week as well about Pete Burling, Hamish, that he is a real student of everything that he can get his hands on. So that's your first place to go. Even, I mean, it's very achievable even in pandemic lockdown as we are in the UK, and you may well be where you're living right now. So there's a lot of work we can do in that direction. And then, of course, it comes back to training in squads again and what you can learn and accelerate that learning when you train in a tight-knit squad. Now, Hamish, I don't know if this is going to be within the realm of your knowledge, but I'm going to ask Jason Pike's question. Hi, Jason. I see you there at top right in my screen. So good evening. You've got a question relating to the core principles of sail trim. You sail a Devoti D1, which is similar in some respects to a fin, I guess, when you're going upwind. It's got an asymmetric downwind, but it's got a full width mainsheet traveler. And I've sailed the D1 a little bit myself. And I remember I didn't know what to do through gusty conditions, whether you play the mainsheet or whether you play the traveler. And that's really the only time I've sailed a boat like that. Hamish, what insights can you provide on upwind trim and technique, and how would you contrast it with a laser and a fin?
Yeah, it's probably, I think it fits in with both a little bit, I would imagine. And I've never seen one, but I'm when you say unstayed rig, that straight away, you know, I think of OK dinghies and lasers and fins, and they're quite unique in that, you know, you're relying totally on the characteristics of the mast. So you need to be sure that you've got yourself a good mast, because you can't, there's no hiding a poor mast, you know, behind, you know, different spreader deflections on whatever. So you've got what you've got. So you want to be first checking that you've got, you know, from right at the big first chapter, that you've got the best equipment you can there in the terms of the mast, and then how you set it up. I'm not sure if you can adjust the base like you can in a fin and change the rake, but obviously, you know, using the tuning guides that you'll find, and it's, we were talking about this earlier, Andy, that these tuning guides are there. You can search any of the sail makers, any of the boat builders, they'll all have probably on their websites tuning guides, and they're a really good tool, because you'll get the headings, if nothing else, even if they're not the same tuning guides that you'd use for your class, but you would actually grab a lot of the headings and start developing your own from those headings. So the fin tuning guide from Devoti probably has a certain rake, mast rake measurement for each wind speed category. I imagine, you know, putting the mast, raking the mast further back in light air and further forward and windy to get more leech tension and a flatter sail would be a good starting point.
Jason, I don't know if you know Nick Craig, but I think he's pretty handy in a Devoti D1. If you don't know Nick, he's a lovely bloke. Look him up on Facebook, ask him a cheeky question, and he'll give you an answer. And, you know, that's maybe after you've watched the YouTube videos I was talking about, your next port of call is Facebook. And and get in touch with the national and the world champions and ask them cheeky questions, because we all live in the friendliest sport there is. So make the most of it. Now let's have a look. What else have we got? Another question from Kevin Kenny. Hamish, do you recommend a big curl or a small curl for the spinnaker? And does this differ in wind speeds or type of spinnaker?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I've always wondered as well, actually, you know, how much curl do you give it? You know, because, you know, clearly some spinnakers will take a fair bit, you know, if they've got some shape in the luff, and others that are very flat in the luff, you know, it'll get a little curl going and then it's gone, it's collapsed. And, you know, I think the first thing when you're trimming a new boat or a new spinnaker is to sort of just know where those limits are. You know, obviously you never want it to collapse, because that's a catastrophe in a way. You know, the whole build from there is quite slow and tedious. So you want the maximum amount of flow. And if you're curling the sail all the time, my imagining is that you're losing a certain amount of connected flow in the front of the sail if it's constantly, you know, going backwards and forwards. So there's to a large degree, if you're losing a lot of it backwards and forwards, and even though the sail might tolerate that, I don't think that can be fast. So I'd be saying that you just want to know that you're getting the most flow. So you'd want to see that it's kind of on edge, and it's telling you that you are as deep in the sheet as you can be. And certain boats don't matter so much either. More tolerant to like a typical asymmetric is probably a lot more tolerant to being oversheeted than a typical symmetrical downwind spinnaker. So there are variations within the class, but the same rules apply. You're really trying to get maximum flow all the time, and you're trying to match that with your main position. What a lot of people forget about is the main and jib position, but your slot is everything. And if you've got your main too far out, even if you have got maximum flow in your spinnaker, or if you've got your main too far in, you know, there's the jib is the same. You need to make sure that all three sails are properly trimmed.
Hamish, when you were campaigning for 70s in the 80s, there was a lot of spinnaker development then, and I got into the class about 10 years after you, and there always seemed to be a choice between a sort of a good workman-like spinnaker that was good and didn't require much attention. And then there were these really twitchy spinnakers that seemed to have higher top end speed, but needed a lot of watching. Now, we know what you chose for your upwind rig. You chose for the sort of the automatic, easy change of gears through conditions, compared with the Steve Benjamin really tweaky rig that needed a lot of adjustment through the gears. What was your philosophy on choosing your spinnaker?
Yeah, it is exactly like you say, it's a compromise. Everything in speed is, you know, you'll find them. A magic solution for one setting or one wind speed burn, and then you'll find that you've lost, you know, a lot out in another. And with the spinnakers you're talking about, the downwind was, you know, rewarded the flat, you know, the bigger spinnakers that were fast on the run, but slow on a reach, more draggy on the reach. So we found in the end that, yeah, I think we leaned a little bit more towards the choices at the time. The starting point was the Sobstad and the Ullmann for us. You know, both of them we looked at before making a decision where we went. But I would say that we were leaning a little bit more towards an easier to use solution, more like what the Ullmann was at the time. And the Sobstad had a bigger, flatter kite, but they were very fast downwind, you know, running. So you knew you had to work harder. But you probably had more choices to work on a run, if you like. So your kinetics and your body movement and the way you sailed had a bigger bearing, or as much of a bearing. Whereas on a reach, you know, you got into the right position on the gunwale and you trimmed the spinnaker well. You know, you were dictated, your speed, final speed was more dictated by your sails.
And as you'll find, as we go further down the road to gold, the choices about what sail that you buy is going to be dictated to some extent by the venue for your next major championship as well. And we really look at how all these things tie together. And I hope you really get a lot out of that further down the line, Kevin. I also did interview Simon Fry, aka Stir Fry, recently, who's one of the top trimmers in the TP52 fleet. He's a world champion in multiple classes, including the TP52 and the Dragon. So I'll happily send you a copy of that interview, because he goes into some depth about how much you should curl the spinnaker in bigger boats, and it might help you with what you're aiming to achieve. And Jason, thanks for acknowledging that Nick Craig is a club mate. So that why are you even asking us about the Devoti D1? You've got the master right next door in the boat park, so go and ask him. We've got a question from Walt Spevak about a particular piece of software called Tactics. That's Tactics with a Q. Tactics.io is the address, is the URL. And it does, I did have a look at it. Well, it looks really interesting. I have come across it before. I just want to say that we are very keen on looking at these new forms of software as much as possible, and bringing that into the Road to Gold as well. And Hamish, you've mentioned one called SailNjord, which is Njord like Norwegian fjord. So SailNjord is one. Just tell us very briefly about how that's helping you with your work with the 49er squad.
Yeah, well, it just provides a bunch of channels, and it keeps those channels can be video, they can be any channel you like, you know. So and allows you to view everything on a timestamp. So when you're coming back and looking at whatever it is you're interested in looking at, and you can then view it at the same time and see, you know, say videos are the obvious one. If you've got two different angles, one from the coach boat and one from a GoPro on your boat, you can look at both of them at the same time. And it just organizes very cleverly all the different channels, and it can manage different streams. It can be data channels or it can be video channels into the same timestamp, and allows you to view it at the same, obviously, simultaneously.
And where do you feel that can really help the coaching process, and where can it start to become a distraction?
Well, it's a really good question, and there's a lot of this stuff becomes a distraction as easily as it's a benefit. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, you've got to keep your eye on the ball in terms of where you're going and where are the biggest priorities. And that's really what we've tried to do with the Road to Gold right through. And that's the key of that test as well, which, you know, checks you on those whole, you know, five pillars of learning within each chapter and all three win categories. So there's a massive amount of information that you'll get tested on, and you'll see clearly where your biggest weaknesses are and where the biggest gains are. So I see that as the key, you know, that you, when you're training, that you keep focusing. And a lot of these technical things can be really, really good if you're ready for that. And when I say that, you know, that's often somebody who's on their third Olympic campaign in the same class, you know, that are looking for stimulation to get sailing, to get motivated, to go out and keep training, and to bring their, you know, the performance curve is really flat at that stage, and they're looking for the next, you know, 1 or 2% gains. Whereas somebody, you know, which is most of us, we're looking across the board at all the things we need to learn, and it's probably not going to be looking for that 1 or 2% in gains, you know, at that point in that particular phase or that chapter. So you've got to be really careful about you know, keeping a helicopter view, keeping perspective of what you really do need to learn to get better overall.
And I think that's right. The Road to Gold gives you that framework. You can lay over whether it's SailNjord or Tactics or Tactics.io or whatever piece of software that you come across. It can look really sexy, and it may well be that it is really sexy, and you hold it up against the Road to Gold framework, and if it's still ticking boxes for you, then it's worth pursuing. Exactly. But some of it may well be a distraction. So, well, that doesn't deal with your question directly, but I do want to tell you that we are going to look at some of these technologies over the weeks to come. If we can bring in some of those companies to do webinars with us, then we will do. So if there's any others that you want to hear about specifically, I've got a couple in mind myself, but rather than prompting you, well, I've given you one sail nure. That's one I'm going to find out more about because Hamish, I know, works with it. But if there's others that you want us to investigate, then please let us know. Hamish, that's just about time. In fact, we've just gone over time and you probably need to rush off to work. How are you getting to work today? Are you stuck in a traffic jam or are you wing-foiling your way there?
Yeah, that'd be good. No, I've got my bike here, my trusty steed on the dock behind me. It's the oldest, shittiest bike I have in my collection. But yeah, I'll be riding. It's only a few miles down the road.
Great. Well, we are about a third of the way down the road as far as Road to Gold is concerned for anybody that joined us when we first opened it up. But I just want to remind you, always ask questions wherever you are on the road to gold, whatever level you're at. Yes, we've got Olympic champions on this call, but that doesn't mean that you can't ask questions as a club racer. We really want to help you, and I hope that you get a sense from all the people that we've heard from this evening that you can ask any question and we will do our best to give you a good answer to it. So I hope you've enjoyed it. Hamish, good to see you again. And nice to see you got a bit of suntan or maybe even sunburn over the last week. And the speed that you were sailing your wing for, it's probably windburn as well. So thank you very much, Hamish. Thank you to those who came on to the call today, to Penny and Russ Clark, to Lily and to John, helping us out with some of those questions. Great questions. And we look forward to seeing you again this time next week when we'll be looking back at Chapter 5, Part 2 of Boat Speed, Race Speed. See you then.
Awesome. Ciao.